Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
We got an oven-ready deal. Put it in the microwave. We can get a new deal. We're aiming for a new deal. I've looked carefully at no deal. That outcome would be a failure of statecraft. The people of this country deserve better from their leaders.
We want a deal.
We are ready to work on solutions.
They don't seem to want to progress a free trade deal.
We want a deal.
There's no point in negotiations proceeding.
Significant differences remain.
No deal.
Trade.
Cherry pick Brexit.
Negotiation.
Deadline.
Deal.
Buenos dias, good afternoon, and welcome to Countdown to Brexit. Yet another Groundhog Day for us, of course, as the talks set to continue. Well, they are continuing. The latest deadline was yesterday. We've gone over that deadline and we're continuing. Obviously, the main deadline, which with the current legal framework is certain that the 31st of December will be the end of the transition period. Whether we have a deal or not, many things, of course, set to change in people's lives, if they're British, of course, and you know, other EU citizens who may be impacted by this. Just before that, because a few people are asking me about it, this travel ban from the UK, it seems at the moment it's not being applied by Spain. European Union officials will talk later on to coordinate a response to this new, more infectious coronavirus variant in the UK, which has led many countries to impose travel bans. Germany, France and Italy are among those to suspend flights from the UK. Outbound train services through the Channel Tunnel have also been halted. Canada is also blocking UK flights. Health officials say the new variant is up to 70% more transmissible, but there's no evidence that it's more deadly, just that it's more infectious, if you like. There's also no proof to suggest that it reacts differently to vaccines. The UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock said the new variant was getting out of control. And Denmark, Italy and the Netherlands have also said that they've detected this variant as well. So at about an hour ago, the European Council meeting of government representatives began. And the speed at which governments have announced their bans on travellers from the UK shows the scale of the alarm. The countries that have acted, France has suspended all travel links, including freight lorries, with the UK for 48 hours. Thousands of lorries move between the countries every day. So that's a particular concern, that it's not just passengers, but freight lorries as well, not allowed out. Eurotunnel said it's suspending access to its Folkestone terminal for traffic heading to Calais. People booked to travel today can get a refund. Trains will still run from Calais to Folkestone, but not the other way. Other countries have taken different action in response to the new virus variant. Denmark suspended flights from the UK for 48 hours. The Netherlands banning all passenger flights from the UK until the 1st of January at the latest, they say. Ferry passengers arriving from the UK will also be barred, although freight will continue into the Netherlands. In the Republic of Ireland, flights arriving from Britain are banned for 48 hours, at least from midnight last night, and people have been asked not to travel to Ireland by air or sea either. Ferry crossings for freight will continue, though, from the UK into Ireland. In Germany, planes from the UK haven't been allowed to land since midnight last night, although cargo is exempt in Germany. Belgium has halted flights and trains. Italy blocked all flights from the UK until the 6th of January. Turkey has temporarily banned all flights from the UK, as has Switzerland. Austria will ban flights from 11 p.m. tonight, UK time, so from midnight tonight, Central European time. Austria is banning all flights from the UK. Anyone arriving in the country, you know, if you get in before midnight tonight, then you'll have to quarantine for 10 days in Austria. Bulgaria has suspended flights both to and from the UK, and their ban will last until the 31st of January. Canada, 72 hours ban as well on passenger flights. And passengers who arrived in Canada from the UK yesterday will be subject to what they call secondary screening and enhanced measures, including increased scrutiny of quarantine plans. So they'll be checking up on you more. India is suspending all flights from the UK until the 31st of December. And there are restrictions in Hong Kong, Israel, Iran, Croatia, Argentina, Chile, Morocco, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, which has imposed a 1-week ban on flights from the UK. So, anyway, this is, of course, as I say, Spain isn't in those. So those of you who, you know, need to get back to Spain or go to Spain, then you should be able to at the moment. This new variant was first detected back in September, it turns out. In November, it made around a quarter of the cases in London. And in mid-December, nearly two-thirds of cases there. Three things are coming together that mean it's attracting attention. One, it's rapidly replacing other versions of the virus. Two, it has mutations that affect parts of the virus likely to be important. And three, some of those mutations have already been shown in the lab to increase the ability of the virus to infect cells. So basically the idea is that it can spread far more easily. We're not absolutely certain. New strains can become more common simply by being in the right place at the right time, such as London. This variant, though, is unusually highly mutated. The most likely explanation is it emerged in a patient with a weakened immune system that was unable to beat the virus. There's no evidence to suggest this variant makes it more deadly. And at least for now, the developed vaccines will almost certainly work against it, the authorities say. However, if the virus changes so it dodges the full effect of the vaccine, then what can happen is something called vaccine escape, and that may be the most concerning element. So that's where we are now. On Brexit, of course, which is the topic of today's programme. Post-Brexit trade talks are continuing today after negotiators failed to reach an agreement over the weekend. Michel Barnier and his UK counterpart David Frost met in Brussels yesterday, but key issues remain unresolved. The European Parliament had said that the talks needed to have ended yesterday in order for it to ratify a deal by the 31st of December. UK government sources are saying that a deal won't be reached unless there's a substantial shift from Brussels. And Brussels, of course, is saying the same sort of thing. It's understood that there's likely to be a decision before Christmas on whether or not a deal could be reached. There was quite an extensive debate in the European Parliament on this. It's about 2.5 hours long, a bit longer than 2.5 hours. And I've chopped down that debate to 10 minutes. And it's just a selection, the sort of random, but I've chosen people from across the political spectrum, the voices that you'll hear. But the main reason I selected them, making it balanced, hopefully, but I selected them because they spoke in English. Yeah. I mean, there are a few. Obviously, most were speaking in their native tongue, and it was dubbed over. But of course, not as interesting as far as radio is concerned. So, the Commission spokesman had this to say yesterday.
I think that there are many issues that are difficult to solve in the question on fisheries. I think nobody is contesting the fact that there are going to be changes after the end of the transition period once the UK leaves the single market and the customs union. What we are working hard on right now is to find a new solution for a future partnership with the UK that can provide a sustainable solution in fisheries and all other questions, by the way, when it comes to our economic partnership, our security partnership, when it comes to internal security, amongst other things. But obviously you'll understand that I can't now go into the nitty-gritty of what our colleagues are discussing right now in the negotiating room down the road.
So we're not getting much information out other than that most things are agreed. Both sides agree, but they're keeping stum, you know, not making it necessarily public in all sorts of areas of government. But there's three things I think we know by now are the issue of fishing rights, the level playing field, so that as the EU sees it, the UK doesn't compete unfairly, and governance. You know, if there's a dispute, how is it resolved? The UK wants an independent panel. I'll ask Jill Rutter from the UK in a Changing Europe, will be coming on the programme a little later on, and I'll ask her about that particular one, because you know me, I think Brexit was a daft idea. I can understand why, obviously. that it happened. People fed up with the establishment, perhaps, and you know. But it does seem to me that if that's what the UK is asking, then that does seem to be reasonable, that it shouldn't be the European Court of Justice that arbitrates on this, because, of course, that is a European Union institution itself. It should be an independent panel. So I'll see if I can get Jill Rutter's take on that. If you have any comments, questions, whatever you might want to say to me, you can do so on WhatsApp. The number is +34 722 177 507. That's +34 722 177 507. John in Mijas says the new COVID variant will not be a worse infection, but if a lot more people contract it, logically a lot more people will die or suffer long COVID. Yeah. I mean, if the vaccine works, you know, with this variant, then it's a question of trying to hold out for time as much as possible, isn't it? Hence the common sense, it would seem, with these rather strict lockdowns that much of England is going through at the moment. Dave in Mallorca says the mutant virus is extraordinarily convenient for Johnson's gang. It provides a range of regulations which are going to be very useful in preventing any and all protest when Brexit shortages start to bite. The blame will be directed towards the virus and away from the criminally inept Westminster government. Yeah, I'm not as cynical as to think that that's why Boris Johnson is imposing these lockdowns. I mean, we put certain things past him, but I don't think this is following the scientific advice, isn't it? I mean, if he did this without that, you know, just for political purposes to try and sort of camouflage the effects of Brexit, you would have people from SAGE, the scientific advisory group of experts, putting their hands up and saying, hang on a minute, this is not what we suggested. So I don't think in this particular case. But yeah, since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, sort of back in January, I suppose, when we first really learned about it, that it's been argued by many people that they will use it as a cover for the damaging economic effects of a no-deal Brexit. You know, in particular, even a deal Brexit, things are going to change. But, of course, the UK wants tariff-free and quota-free access, and the EU saying that comes with terms and conditions. You know, cakeism. Richard in London says, I heard last night on the radio in London how some people believe that the EU's reaction on shutting borders is simply a punishment for Brexit. I know some people would say that. It's not so much punishment, but I do wonder if the UK were still in the EU, whether this ban would be as severe as it is at the moment. Of course, as the UK is outside the European Union, then it doesn't have any influence over these decisions, doesn't have any say. Ed Peters says, it's about defence. Whose finger's on the nuclear button? Don't quite follow. Richard says, morons, we're surrounded by morons. What was that line? I've forgotten the line now, from Kenneth Williams. Yeah, something like that. talking of fish, Jérôme Viquelin is a French fisherman on the North Coast, where something like 60% of the fish that they fish there comes from the British economic zone, which extends 200 miles off the coast. Most of it, interestingly, if Scotland were to become independent, then most of those waters would actually be Scottish waters rather than English waters. Obviously, the 200-mile limit is narrowed when you've got something like the English Channel in the way. Then it's down the middle, halfway between France and England. Here's Jérôme Viquelin.
We're scared because UK waters represent 40 to 60% of our revenue. So for us, it would be catastrophic. It's unimaginable. The British export some 70% of their fish to the EU. If we get to December 31st and they throw us out of their waters, then we will block our ports, stop the ferries. No British boats will reach French soil.
The EU market needs fish. It imports it. France imports 80% of the seafood it consumes. So we need UK fish. So although we can pressure the British and threaten tariffs and border controls, it's not a long-term solution. Because for our fishermen to live, they need to fish.
Thank you, Peter and Ben Almada and Richard in London. That's it. That's what I was trying to think of. Kenneth Williams going, infamy, infamy. They've all got it infamy. Yes. It'd be interesting, though, that that fisherman there, Jérôme Vicolin, saying that if we're denied access to British waters, then we will blockade French ports and no British boat is coming in. He didn't say just fishing boats. Is this sort of, you know, predictable? Is it reasonable? Not reasonable as in a good idea, but is it reasonable to think that French fishermen would do that? I think very much so. I mean, they have a history of this sort of thing, for better or worse, not condemning it or commending it. But so that, you know, that'll be interesting, you know, as far as post-Brexit Britain's exports are concerned. A Bob also, thank you, infamy. We all got it, infamy. Nigel Mills, MP... Michael Gove was sitting in, looks like the Cabinet Office or something. He sat there with David Frost, the UK's negotiator, and he was grilled by MPs on the progress of talks at the moment. Rather bizarrely, he's got the camera sort of down at the side, so he keeps turning his head rather than putting the camera in front of him. I don't know what that's about.
So that's a fixed point of law, Secretary of State. Does that mean there were no situations where talks would continue past the end of the year, that if there's no deal by then, that's it for a long time? Or...
Yes.
So that's absolutely certain. There would not be any agreement next year. We wouldn't go back to the negotiating table.
Yes, I think it's been the view has been expressed by some that if there is no agreement by December the 31st, that we would go back to the negotiating table a month, 2 months, or in 3 months' time. That would be it. We would have left on WTO terms. It's still the case, of course, that there would be contact between the UK and European nations and politicians, as one would expect. But what we would not be doing is attempting to negotiate a new deal. No.
OK, thank you. Can I just ask a few questions about the level playing field? I mean, is that the stickiest point of the negotiations, or is this, has a way through been found on this now?
There are three areas, I think the committee knows, which are particularly sticky. The level playing field, then what's called governance, or the capacity of either side to take retaliatory measures if observance of the level playing field is considered not to be adhered to, and then fisheries.
So which one's the most sticky? Is it, I mean, the media reports that ways through have been found on level playing field and enforcement. Is that the case?
Well, there are there's lots of media report and lots of speculation, but must maintain the integrity of the negotiating process and the confidences that are there.
In other words, I'm not telling you. Fair enough. I mean, the European Commission, because they're still, of course, in negotiations, and the European Commission is doing the same, keeping pretty shtum about this. As that was Nigel Mills there, virtually grilling Michael Gove. Peter Bone is another Conservative MP, very much a prominent Brexiteer.
The Prime Minister has made it clear that United Kingdom will thrive whether we have a free trade deal with the European Union or whether we trade on WTO rules or Australian style. Would you agree with the Prime Minister's Secretary of State that we will thrive in either case?
Yes.
So, given that, we know that trading on WTO rules ticks all the boxes from the referendum. It returns control of our trade, returns control of our laws, and returns control of our borders. So why haven't we opted for that, given that we are now on the 17th of December, and the European Union said the latest date an agreement could be made was the 31st of October?
Well, we want to make sure that if we can secure a free trade agreement, we do. You're quite right that at the moment, the most likely outcome is that we will leave on WTO terms, that we will have an Australian-style outcome. But, of course, a free trade agreement removing, as it would, tariffs on UK exporters is certainly something to be desired. And, of course, were we able to secure the agreement that we want to, we would be the only country to have a zero tariff, zero quota, only third country to have a zero tariff, zero quota trade agreement with the EU.
Hmm. Key point there, you see. Michael Gove himself said it, the only country in the world to have, if they'd managed to get it across the line, to have a zero tariff, zero quota access to the single market. The EU is offering that, but of course they're saying as long as there's the level playing field. That's clearly what you need. Richard sent me, I remember this, on the White Cliffs of Dover, there's an organisation, a lobby group that is very much against Brexit called Led by Donkeys. And they put out a series of like banners and posters and signs and things that resemble tweets, although they're not all tweets. But there's one here, Dominic Raab, saying, I hadn't quite understood the full extent of this, but we are particularly reliant on the Dover-Calais crossing. You remember him saying that? Interesting, with that fisherman that I played before, and Richard says, after the interview, the fisherman shrugged, lit up a gitan and left. I can imagine. he says, meanwhile, David Davis, the man who claimed in 2016 that Brexit would be done in a couple of calls to Angela Merkel, now claims it was always likely to stretch to 2021. The brutal truth is British voters didn't really vote to leave the EU. What they really did was to use the EU referendum as a proxy to vote to leave the reality of 21st century Britain. There is no solution to this problem, Richard says, until people realise this. No solution whatsoever. Ed, on this theme of the nuclear button, says one day those in the Russian orbit will become members. This has all been fired by the right-wing defence community. It has nothing to do with economics. I still don't follow, I'm afraid, how that has got anything to do with Brexit, the defence industry. Hearing Peter Bone there, it reminded me, and I dug it up, it's an old one, but when John Bercow was still the speaker, and he would say, Mr. Peter Bone, Mr. Peter Bone, and somebody put it to music rather appropriately this week, of course, because as you know, a couple of days ago, it was the 250th anniversary of the birth of Beethoven.
Mr. Peter Bone. Mr. Peter Bone.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
Son las 12:30, it's 12:30. Remember, the WhatsApp number for Europe Today and Countdown to Brexit, indeed, is +34 722 177 507. And I'm delighted to be joined once again by Jill Rutter from the UK in a Changing Europe, a senior fellow there. Good afternoon, Jill. Well, good morning to you.
Good morning from London.
Hi. Jill, one thing a couple of listeners have been asking me about, this variant of the coronavirus that we're seeing in London and in the southeast, and this has led to travel restrictions, many countries imposing them, not Spain so far, but cancelling flights basically from the UK into those countries. And some listeners are suggesting that it might be some sort of punishment for Brexit. Do you think if the UK was still in the EU that there would have been any difference there?
That's an interesting question. It's probably one to ask people in the EU rather than the UK. What might have happened, I think? Well, we did see that in the early stages of COVID that individual European countries did put up barriers even within the Schengen area. I mean, the UK has never been a member of Schengen. So I don't think that's as a protection against that. I think public health trumps EU solidarity on borders. And we saw that back in the summer. Obviously, the Commission then moved in to say, don't do this. But that was the first reaction, that the health of our public comes first. And these are, at the moment, only temporary restrictions. I think the interesting thing, and maybe a slightly different take on it, would be if the UK were still a full EU member. Obviously, we're in transition still for the next 10 days or so. But if the UK was still an EU member, would we have coordinated more with member states? I think we notified the WHO, but would we have been talking with them through the EU early warning system? And would they therefore have felt slightly less blindsided? I mean, frankly, us sitting here in London were pretty blindsided on Saturday night when we were sitting here. People started scrambling for... No, not for airports, but for train stations, car journeys and things like that to try and get out of Tier 4 before the curtain fell at midnight. So I think, you know, it's sort of difficult. It's a sort of panicky reaction, and people have done that. So I'm not sure it made a substantive difference in the short run, but I think we might have seen a more coordinated response, if you like, between the UK and member states, because they seem to have not particularly been warned by the UK that it was about to take these measures.
We're hearing slightly different messages from both sides on this issue of fish, one of the three sticking points. From the EU side, the likes of Ursula von der Leyen making sounds like saying, we're getting closer. I think we're nearly there. And on the UK side, we're getting leaks or information sources saying we're nowhere near there. That doesn't seem to be, that doesn't seem to bode well. Michael Gove was asked to give a percentage figure, and he said less than 50% chance of getting a deal. He was also asked, if we don't get a deal in time, because, of course, it needs to be translated, any deal into 23 languages, whatever it is, those parliaments need to ratify, then the European Parliament needs to ratify. So that some talk of sort of temporarily implementing it, if we get a deal, and then the European Parliament can ratify it next year, January, for example. Is that feasible?
Well, the EU has this process called provisional applications. So the EU can, if the member states agree in the council that they've got a deal, then it can be provisionally applied. And actually, the European Parliament can take really quite a long time then to get round to approving it. Obviously, members of the European Parliament, and that was one reason why they tried to set yesterday evening as a deadline, but member states didn't seem particularly moved by that, was saying, well, you know, we hate provisional application because basically that takes it out of our hands. It effectively bypasses the Parliament. So we're prepared to sit next week, but we want a deal that we can look at, and we need that by Sunday night. That's clearly not happened. I have to say, my view now, having watched all these briefings and counter-briefings over the last bit of this end game of Brexit, is it's almost like a seesaw. When the European Commission says things are stuck, the UK is saying we're making progress. The moment the European Commission makes some more positive sounding noises, the UK feels it has to go in the other direction and signal to its domestic audience, no, we're not making concessions, we're standing firm. We're really still miles apart. So I think they're, frankly, you know, it's a bit like there's sort of nothing's agreed till everybody's agreed. Until we actually see them come out of the tunnel with a piece of paper or walk away saying, actually, it's no deal, I just think these briefings and counter-briefings are to be looked at and just, you know,
if I understand it correctly, trade deals require unanimity. So all of the 20 on the EU side, all 27 have to agree. It's not qualified majority voting. It's unanimity. And these things are done according to the constitutional requirements of each country. As we know, so like Ireland requires a referendum to change the constitution. Belgium has the likes of Wallonia, all these things. If it's applied, and then going into sort of, say, January, the parliament, let's say, of one country doesn't support it. What are you going to do? Sort of have it in place for a couple of months and then, oh, no, sorry, end it.
Well, I think you'll find that, you know, I'm not sure that the Canada deal is even properly still fully approved. I think the more the more issues that are entirely EU competence, the less role for national parliaments anyway in this. And the bit that national parliaments have a say on is where it affects national competences and things like that. And I think both sides have been quite keen to pare back this deal as far as possible to something that makes it mostly within EU competence. That'll be a bit different for security issues and things like that. One of the questions is whether the European Council would agree to provisionally apply the whole thing, or just parts that I think were matters of EU competence. They can decide to do things. If they think they've got a good deal and they want that continuity, then I think they can decide to go ahead, and then you can wait for that long process. And what we've seen on various things where national parliaments have created problems is that you know, it's been solved by the issuing of clarifications and things like that. It hasn't actually gone back to reopen the deal, though ultimately I suppose that's where you might end up. But it would at least offer a bit of continuity over the year end. But interestingly, Philippe Lambert from the European Parliament was on the UK radio this morning suggesting maybe there ought to be some sort of provisionally applied, but not of the full trade agreement, an interim standstill agreement that would then be provisionally applied to give more time for the finalisation of the negotiations and a proper scrutiny by the European Parliament before the big trade deal, future relationship agreement came into force, because that would, and he thought that'd be preferable. The only problem is that the thing we know is that any hint of staying in the Brexit transition regime for any longer than the 31st of December is anathema to the Prime Minister's backbenches. He's already getting huge amounts of grief from them. The two groups overlap enormously on the people who are hardline on Brexit, the people who are hardline on COVID restrictions for his Christmas U-turn. So he's in grief if he tried to do that.
The likes of Andrew Bridges and Peter Bone, the other day when he was in a conference meeting with Michael Gove and David Frost, he seemed to be, to be fair, he's always been like this, but he seemed to be suggesting that any deal would be a bad thing because it would require British compromise. So much, much better to have no deal, or Australia, as they like to
The government's really dug itself into a bit of a hole here, because the Prime Minister says he wants a deal, but at the same time, and Peter Bone in that select committee hearing played this back to Michael Gove, the British government keeps on saying, but we have nothing to fear from an Australia-style deal. We will, prosper mightily. And so Peter Bone was putting it to Michael Gove, saying, well, if you think we'll prosper mightily with this, why on earth are we bothering? Because any deal is going to require a bit of British movement. And it's, it's quite... we've got to a situation rather than, a bad deal, no deal is better than a bad deal, to say that almost, no deal is better than any deal if you're a sort of, pure Brexit supporter, and Peter Bone always has been in that position. But the government, frankly, because it's failed to spell out the consequences of no deal, or to be honest about the consequences of no deal, has failed in that sense to make any sort of case to people who are sceptical on that, of why it's better to have a deal. The pro-deal Conservatives, on the government's backbenches, are much more silent in comparison. You get some of the ones who are no longer in Parliament and were tracked out of the party last year tweeting about it, but the ones in Parliament, I think, don't want to be seen to be undermining or weakening the government's negotiating hand. So they're sort of, making private overtures rather than public pressure.
There are voices, and I suppose there's no definitive answer to this, but there are some people that might suggest that one part of the Brexit crowd, say in Parliament in particular, that that they're actually interested in some sort of disaster capitalism, shorting the pound and so on, that they've planned. I have no evidence for this, of course, but that they've planned for no deal, some people might stand to make some money from, for example, shorting sterling. Classic William Rees-Mogg wrote the book on it, of course. Naomi Klein wrote the critical book of it on disaster capitalism. What credibility do you give to that? Clearly not the majority of people who voted for it, but a certain contingent.
I mean, there'll undoubtedly be some people, in the market watching every move and looking for opportunities to make money from it, in the same way as, a lot of money was made around Black Wednesday, when the UK, of people betting against the UK being able to maintain its commitment to stay in the European exchange rate mechanism. So I'm sure there are people there. I think, whatever you think of most of the Brexit supporters in the government and certainly in the country, they actually are mostly people who have principled objections to UK membership of the EU. I mean, and we're seeing this, and this is why this negotiation is getting so difficult, and it's quite difficult to sell a compromise, is they have quite an absolutist view of what being a sovereign nation comes. They've also are highly suspicious of the EU attempts to impose its reach and to make sure that the UK doesn't pose any sort of threat to the European project. So, you know, I don't know whether very many of them are actually poised to make huge killings out of it. I think, you know, most of them have, you know, you may disagree, but I would say most of them have more honourable motives than that.
No, sure. I don't mean the people. I suppose I was referring to, you know, the likes of some people with significant investment portfolios that
unstable markets. And, you know, this Brexit ever since the referendum has been a major source of market instability.
The pound is down 16.42%.
Very volatile markets are an opportunity, you know, to make money, you know, so frankly is the pandemic, you know, when you see what that's done to share prices, if you think that actually the market's overshot dramatically. Then,
especially if you get yourself a PPE contract.
I don't know that that's motivating, you know, I don't know that that's a sort of, you know, I describe that as a key government motivation here.
Okay. Just two more quick questions before I let you go. Michael Gove, in that meeting, that select committee meeting, he was asked by Lord Kerr, I think it was, if we don't get some sort of deal, would you be prepared to continue negotiating, you know, into 2021? And which voices from the EU have suggested. And Michael Gove has absolutely ruled that out. Do you think that's true? I mean, they say things one day and then, you know, they just, at least we've got them on the record on Twitter or so on. But do you think that's the case? It doesn't seem to be very sort of sensible, really, that if we have no deal, that why, if it's offered, why wouldn't you continue to negotiate?
Well, I think what the UK has been saying is that it's quite keen to have a sort of series of, I mean, the Prime Minister's always talked about the possibility of a series of mini deals, so that you would look to put in place some deals. Yeah, at the moment, the EU, for example, is envisaging unilateral measures on things like aviation and road transport, connectivity, stuff like that. So I think the UK would definitely be up for negotiating a series of sectoral deals like that, might make it look a bit more like Switzerland. I think the difficulty for the government is if they've gone right up to a deadline and failed to reach agreement because of this standoff on level playing field, dispute resolution and fish, I think the EU thinks that the UK, you know, this is certainly what over here is reported to be the view of Monsieur Macron, the President Macron, the French government, is a sort of, you know, shamefaced UK will come back and basically sign on a dotted line a deal that it rejected in December, sometime in sort of March or something, because the UK will be suffering so badly from no deal. Well, if that happens, then it might be a different government by then. Who knows? It might be a different prime minister. But I think, you know, to go back over the same ground that they've been going over all this year without some sign of, you know, without some significant political change would be quite different. But if they, you know, but it might make sense to say, can we do a deal on, you know, can we actually put in place stuff on security arrangements and things like that, things that aren't crucial to the big, big central trade deal. I think it's much harder for the UK to come back quickly and be negotiating the trade deal. But also, you know, if you're Michael Gove, the thing that the UK thinks, and the UK has, you know, Brexit supporters have always thought that it is only by having a heart, this is one reason why they didn't want an extension in the summer, is that the EU always pushes things and only ever moves right at the last minute. And, you know, so doing a deal with no deadline with the EU would be hugely harder to get a good deal, to get a decent deal, than to do a deal with a deadline. So the other thing he's doing is to say, no, this don't think you can come back and, you know, get tariff-free access to the UK market and go our fishing next year.
I played earlier on the programme today a French fisherman, basically, and it's a very credible threat, suggesting that if French fishermen are denied access to British waters, they'll blockade French ports and they won't allow any British boats in. That's what he said.
Yeah,
and we know that they have a history.
That's quite likely. But equally, you know, if they, you know, equally for the French fishermen, their big problem is, I mean, yeah, I think that's quite possible, frankly, with a deal as well, because any deal will reduce French access. But once you've taken back control of those waters and, you know, held out to our fishermen the prospect that they will get all of that back, then very difficult, you know, much harder for the UK government to take that away again, I think.
Mm. Just one last thing. This issue of governance, you know, arbitration, so there's a dispute between the two sides, who gets to, you know, to decide on this. As I understand it, the UK government wants a sort of an independent panel, perhaps made up of, you know, a chair and three from each side, like the Supreme Court or something like that. That seems to be a pretty reasonable request from the UK, doesn't it? I don't understand why
it's
has a problem
with
that.
I think, you know, that is actually quite a sensible proposal from the UK. I know what the EU is worried about is just the length of time that takes. Because that's one of the reasons why we've had this discussion on the sort of, particularly on the state aid side, about taking lightning tariffs and autonomous action so that the EU doesn't have to go through some sort of process beforehand. But I think the UK is, you know, actually right to say that's not the way in which you do things in these sorts of agreements. We do see people implementing trade defence, but, you know, it's much better to do that. And that's actually exactly what's been agreed for Northern Ireland last week. Or earlier this week, we saw a list of names nominated by both sides of eminent lawyers to sit on the arbitration panels, to be available for the arbitration panels to oversee the implementation of the withdrawal agreement. I don't think that's too absurd and ask from the UK.
No. Yeah,
I mean, and I think it's a sensible landing point. It's one that's already been conceded in principle by the EU for the withdrawal agreement.
That's right. And we only have to look at the World Trade Organization to see just how long they take to make up their mind. Final question for you, Jill, just the very last one. Is it true that the EU normally blinks at the last minute? That's what they're saying.
I think this is very interesting because I don't think you have... The problem is there is no precedent for this sort of negotiation to extrapolate from. So, yeah, the thing I think that the Brexit supporters... You know, who've argued that, look at is the internal budget settling disputes or fishing quota carve-ups or, you know, things about how on earth to deal with migration where we see everybody, all those member states sitting together, goes very late in the night or the negotiations in Maastricht or whatever, and, you know, then they're settled very late. If you look at trade agreements, you know, those don't tend to have a deadline. But what you have with trade agreements, two things. They go on forever and a day. They take years and years to settle. So they're not up against some sort of artificial deadline. But the thing, if you don't reach an agreement with somebody, you know, there's the EU-Australia talks going on now. If you, or the TTIP talks with the US, if both sides decide they don't want to do a deal, you know, that the deal's not going to be in their interests, you can actually just walk away and continue trading as now. What's so different about the Brexit negotiations now, and similar to the ones on the withdrawal agreement last year and the year before, is what you see now is that the trouble is that on the 31st of December, the trading arrangement between the UK and the EU, both of which are extraordinarily significant trading partners to each other, changed dramatically with no deal. So it's not like any normal agreement. So So there is a huge big incentive on both sides to try to deliver a deal by the 31st. But I mean, that the thing is, it's not just, you know, they blink, we blink. You know, I mean, at the moment, both sides think the other one is the one that ultimately confronted with the prospects of that dramatic change on the 31st of December. Mm. Is the one that blinks, and that's what everybody is waiting for. Who blinks first?
Well, let's hope they both blink. That's all I can say. Jill Rutter from the UK in a Changing Europe. Thanks. Always a pleasure and highly informative as ever. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
Well, we're nearly out of time. The, you know, those 10 minutes or so that I clipped together of that European parliamentary session that took place in Brussels. I'll play that for you tomorrow because I thought it was obviously more interesting to speak to Jill there. Nigel Farage has tweeted, "We're dealing with thugs and bullies who want to make us sign a bad deal. Time to walk away. To hell with the EU." It really is, you know, this is shooting yourself in the foot, isn't it, or in the head. You know, those cartoons that have been doing the rounds, somebody pointing a gun at their own head and saying, if you don't give me what I want, I'll shoot. The EU, meanwhile, scratches its head and says, all right, we'd rather you didn't shoot, but shoot. Farage has also tweeted, "The Chinese Communist Party don't like the truth and always respond aggressively. They should pay the West reparations for this global disaster." Hmm. And he's been trolled by some Chinese people. A guy called Chen Weihua says, "Wear a mask and stop talking SH1T. Put the mask on and shut up. Toby in Romford says, "What do you think the Prime Minister has done right during this pandemic? And two, is a no deal worth the price for sovereignty?" It all comes down to your definition of sovereignty, doesn't it? Richard has answered those questions. One, nothing. What's he done right? Some things, maybe. And two, is a no deal worth the price for sovereignty? No. Yeah, you know, everything, membership of NATO, membership of the WTO itself, of course, requires compromise. You play by the rules, so you therefore surrender a degree of your sovereignty. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Jill Rutter, of course. Thanks to Giles Brown for engineering on the Costa del Sol. And I'll speak to you all tomorrow. Selina McKenzie is up next. Have a lovely afternoon. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.